Today's talk will be on mindfulness and everyday life. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Good evening, everyone. Okay, this evening we will be taking sutta number 79 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is called the Chula Sakulu Dai Sutta, the shorter discourse to Sakulu Dai, and this begins on page 654. Already some, now it's a couple of years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, we did sutta number 77. That was the larger or longer discourse to Sakulu Dai. So now we take the shorter version. Okay, so this sutta begins at a time when the Buddha was living in Rajagaha. This was the capital of the state of Magadha, in the bamboo grove. And at that time, there was this wanderer whose name was Sakulu Dai, who was living in a place called the Peacock's Sanctuary. Okay, so the sutta begins actually very much like several of the others that we recently came across. Here, the Buddha, in the morning, he gets dressed, and he heads towards Rajagaha to go on alms round. But he must have set out a little earlier than usual, and so when he reaches the city, then he thinks, or he gets near the city, then he thinks it's too early to go for alms in Rajagaha. So he will go to the Peacock Sanctuary in order to meet the wanderer Sakulu Dai. And so we come to that stock passage that as the Buddha is approaching the Peacock Sanctuary, the wanderer Sakulu Dai, surrounded by a large company of wanderers, are sitting there making an uproar, talking loudly, speaking about many pointless things. So when the Buddha approaches, then he asks Udai, "What is the discussion that you were involved with as you were sitting together now? And what was your discussion that was interrupted?" Okay, so now maybe Sakulu Dai is a little embarrassed to tell the Buddha what he was speaking about. And so he says, "Let be that discussion that we were involved with as we were sitting here. You can hear about it later." And then he says, "When I don't come to the assembly, then it sits talking many kinds of pointless talk. But when I come to the assembly, then it sits, with all of the people sit looking up at me, thinking, let us hear what kind of Dhamma the recluse Udai expounds." And so the word Dhamma, you see, doesn't mean only the Buddha's teaching, but it was used. Each of the teachers that was contemporary with the Buddha would have his own teaching, and they all referred to their own teaching as the Dhamma. So each one had his own Dhamma, his own doctrine, his own teaching, his own way of practice. Okay, but then Udai goes on, "However, when the Blessed One, the Buddha, comes, then both I and the assembly sit looking up to the Blessed One, thinking, let us hear the Dhamma, that the Blessed One expounds. So Udayi must have had very high regard for the Buddha, because on an earlier occasion they had met and the Buddha had expounded to him in quite extensive detail the types of practices that are undertaken in his own teaching. This was in Sutta number 77, and so as a result of that discussion, Sakaludayi would have developed this high regard for the Buddha. Okay, so now the Buddha says to Sakaludayi, please suggest something that I should speak about. Then Udayi tells him something that had been taking place recently. Okay, he says, Bhante, Venerable Sir, in recent days there was one claiming to be omniscient and all-seeing. The Pali words used here are sabanyu and sabadasavi. The two words mean pretty much the same thing. And so to claim to be sabanyu means to be claiming to know everything. And to claim to be sabadasavi means to claim to see everything. So in that case, somebody who is omniscient and all-seeing, according to the way the text is understood, has to know and see absolutely everything. In other words, to be omniscient. And so he claims to have complete knowledge and vision under all conditions. He says, whether I'm walking, standing, sleeping, or awake, knowledge and vision are continuously and uninterruptedly present to me. Do you know who this is that he's referring to? Actually, it's going to mention who it is in the text, so we'll just go on. Okay, so then Udayi continues, when I asked him a question about the past, like this is a way of testing. When I asked him a question about the past, he prevaricated, led the talk aside, and showed anger, hatred, or ill will, and bitterness. That is because probably Udayi knew something about the past and wanted to test his omniscience. So he asked him some question about the past, and the person who's making this claim couldn't answer. And so he'll talk about something else, or just go rambling without making any sense. And then if you press him, well, that's not what I'm asking you about. Tell me what happened in the past. Then he gets angry and becomes bitter. It reminds me of something that happened in Sri Lanka some years ago. I was told that there was a certain woman who was able to channel people who have died and passed away, and you could actually speak to your deceased friends through this woman, and she was able to get, like, you know, information sometimes from, like, great monks, great meditation teachers who have died, and you could find out facts from them about higher realms of existence. And so somebody persuaded me to go see her because at that time my teacher, Venerable Nyanaponika, had died a few years earlier. And so I was told that this woman would be might be able to channel Venerable Nyanaponika. And so I thought it might be interesting to go. I was a little skeptical, but I thought it might be an interesting experiment just to see whether there's any truth to this claim. So I went along, and then they called this woman, and she came up, and then she sat down, and then she goes into a kind of trance. And then we asked her channel for Venerable Nyanaponika. Okay, then she's sitting, then her body shakes a little. Then she starts speaking with a different voice. Hello, how are you? Then I asked her, do you know my name? And then she said, you are Bhikkhu Bodhi. But, I mean, people could have told her that Bhikkhu Bodhi is going to be coming to see her when she was the actual woman. So that could have been in her subconscious. Okay, then I thought, you know, I'm a little bit mischievous character. So I said, what was the name of the organization that you established in Sri Lanka that's now operating in Kandy? Then she got angry at me. And she said, you shouldn't be skeptical. Your problem is that you're doubting too much. You're not able to place trust. And then she came out from the trance. I think she was really in a trance. I don't think that this was a show that she was putting on. But I don't think that was Venerable Nyanaponika speaking through her. Okay, so this teacher, when asked about the past, he gets angry and bitter. Okay, so then Udayi thinks that surely the Buddha is the one who's skilled in these things. He would be able to tell what has gone on in the past. But now the Buddha asks him, sometimes I suspect some of these things, like this passage here. It seems to me a little bit like this is an attempt by the Buddhists to put down their rival, who were the Jains. Because generally we can see in the Buddhist texts the relationship between the Buddhists and the Brahmins. So they have different teachings. The Buddha is critical of some of the Brahmin teaching. But when the Brahmins meet the Buddha, usually their relationship is cordial, friendly, kind of respectful, mutually respectful. But when it comes to contact between the Buddhists and the Jains in the Buddhist texts, there's really this strong tendency to put the Jains down, to show up faults in their teaching, inner contradictions. And so this, because they were both operating almost in the same part of India, maybe trying to appeal to the same social classes. So whether this all comes from the Buddha or whether later monastic community has put these passages in order to show how superior the Buddhas are to the Jains, this I don't know. But the Buddha is shown asking, who is it that was making this claim to be omniscient and all-seeing, and yet he showed anger and hatred and bitterness? Then Udayi says, it was the Nigantha Nataputta. That is the person that we know as Mahavira, the historical, can't say the founder of Jainism, because Jainism probably goes back even hundreds of years before the time of the Buddha. But he's the most prominent historical teacher in the lineage of Jainism. Okay, so now the Buddha continues that he's not going to engage in discussions about the past or the future. So he says, if someone should recollect his many past lives then we could have a discussion about the past, what had happened in earlier periods, earlier lives. So then in that case, we could have a discussion. He could satisfy my mind with his answer to my question, and I could satisfy his mind with my answer to his question. And then as for discussions about the future, what happens to somebody after death, where they've been reborn, if somebody has the divine eye, that is the ability to see where beings are reborn through their karma, then we could have a discussion about the future, where somebody has been reborn. But now the Buddha is going to put aside these discussions about the past, about the future, as not being critically important. The Buddha wants to focus on the essence or core of his own teaching, which is the Dhamma, the principle, the essential principle. And so he says, let be the past, Udayi. Let be the future. I will teach you the Dhamma. Then he just explains the central principle of dependent origination. Not the elaboration, but just the core principle. When this exists, that comes to be. When this arises, that arises. When this does not exist, that does not come to be. With the cessation of this, that ceases. So that is the essence of dependent origination. Okay, so now Udayi speaks, and he's going to say that, he says, I cannot even remember everything that I've experienced in this present life, so how can I recollect my many past lives? So, in other words, he doesn't have the ability to recall his past lives. And then I don't even have the ability to see with the divine eye, to see what's called a mud goblin. This is Pangsu Pisachika. Yeah, he can't even see a mud goblin. This is a kind of supersensory being that they hang out in muddy swamps and ponds, mischievous little beings. And those with the supersensory perception are able to see them, but he says, I'm not able to see them. So how can I have, with the divine eye that can see, beings taking rebirth in accordance with their karma? But then Udayi says, when the Blessed One says, when this exists, with the arising of this, that arises, even that I don't understand. I'm confused even about that. And then he says, maybe I can satisfy the Buddha by answering a question about my own teacher's doctrine, about the doctrine that's come down in my own lineage of teachers. So now the Buddha asks him, well, what is it that is taught in your own lineage? He wants to know what are the doctrines to which Udayi subscribes and what he proclaims. Then Udayi seems to have just a saying that has been transmitted within his lineage. It goes in Pali, Ayang Paramo Vanno, Ayang Paramo Vanno, which means this is the supreme or most excellent beauty or splendor. This is the supreme, most excellent splendor. So now we're going to see how the Buddha is quite a subtle debater who wants to clarify the meaning of terms. You know, this is what happens to followers of different religions. Without clarifying the meaning of terms, they can invest a lot of emotion, either positive emotion or negative emotion, in the objects of their belief. Like sometimes in a discussion, somebody will ask, So you're a Buddhist. Do you believe in God? And so there's a lot of emotional force invested in that word, God. And so we might find ourselves a little bit in a quandary. How do we answer? Like if we say yes, then he assumes that we accept the idea of God in the same way that he himself believes in it. Then he'll think either you're with me, or else he'll try to prove and argue his conception of God is superior to our conception of God. If one says no, then he'll think you're an atheist, you're a materialist, you're immoral, you don't have any chance of salvation. Like there was an American news commentator, I don't remember who it was, when Tiger Woods claimed to be a Buddhist, that he said on Fox News, then Tiger Woods should reject his Buddhism because it doesn't offer him the same chance of redemption that we have because we believe in Jesus Christ. And he should turn to Jesus Christ for redemption. Okay, but if somebody says, do you believe in God? Then you have to ask him, what do you mean by God? So you have to ask the question, what do you mean by these terms? In this case, the Buddha asks him, okay, you say that is the supreme splendor, that is the supreme splendor, but what exactly do you mean by this supreme or perfect splendor? And then Udayi is apparently he's stumped, but he doesn't want to admit it. So he just defines the supreme splendor in a kind of logically, we call it tautologous way. It's just really like saying, what do you mean? You say 2 + 2 = 4. Or somebody says, I have 4 oranges. What do you mean you have 4 oranges? Well, I have 3 oranges plus 1 orange. Therefore, I have 4 oranges. So 3 + 1 is the same thing as 4. So he says, that splendor is the perfect splendor, which is unsurpassed by any splendor that is higher or more excellent, more sublime. That's really just another way of saying the supreme splendor is the supreme splendor. Because the Pali word parama, supreme or perfect, means that which has nothing higher or better. But the Buddha doesn't let him get away with this, but then carries the question to the second level. The Buddha says, what is that splendor which is unsurpassed by any splendor, any other splendor that is higher or more excellent? And then Udayi says, that's, actually I think the translation would be better, that splendor which, for which there is no other splendor higher or more sublime, is the perfect splendor, the supreme splendor. In other words, he's just turning the tautology around. So you say three plus one equals four, and then you say, what exactly is four? Four is 3 + 1. So you're really just saying the same thing in two different ways. Okay, so now the Buddha is going to use a simile or an analogy to show Udayi how, you could say, silly or empty his claim is. He says, Udayi, you might continue in this way for a long time. You just go on saying, that splendor is the perfect splendor, which is unsurpassed by any other splendor, but you don't indicate, you don't really explain clearly what that splendor is. Now comes the simile. Suppose a man were to say, I am in love with the most beautiful girl in this country. Okay, then people ask him, this girl who is the most beautiful in the country, the one who you're in love with, do you know whether she is from the Kshatriya class or the Brahmin class, the merchant class or the worker class? Of course, for us, it doesn't really, wouldn't really matter what class she's from. If we see a beautiful girl, we don't ask whether she is from a family of, say, business executives or factory workers or a servant, or doctors or lawyers or whatever. But we just, we know what the girl looks like. And so we say that's the most beautiful girl in the country. But maybe for the Indians in that time, it's important to know if you're going to fall in love with a girl, you have to know what social class she's from. Okay, so they ask, do you know what class she's from? And he says, no. Good man, that most beautiful girl in the country with whom you're in love, do you know her name and clan? Of course, for us also, we could see a beautiful girl, fall in love with her, but we don't even know her name and clan. So it seems to me that's not really a disqualification. But then they go on to ask, do you know whether she's tall, short, or of middle height? He says, no. So it seems he's not really seen her. Do you know whether she is dark-skinned or brown-skinned or light-skinned? He says, no. Do you know what village or town or city she lives in? Again, he says, no. Then finally they ask the really key question, the question that hits on the central point. Then do you love a girl that you've never even met, that you've never even seen, that you don't know at all? And then he says, yes, I'm in love with her. Then the Buddha says, wouldn't that man's talk just amount to nonsense? I think the Pali expression, apati hirakattang, it seems it doesn't really mean so much nonsense, but more to be something unconvincing, or let's say, without any cogency to it. Because the statement itself makes sense, it has meaning, but it would seem almost a contradiction for a man to be saying that he's in love with the girl, even though he's never seen her. So, wait a moment. Thinking of cases of people who have had correspondence, they've never... You know... Excuse me? You've had that experience?
I've heard stories.
Yeah. There was a particular case that come across my mind, but okay, well, let us suppose that they never even exchanged letters. Okay, so Udayi admits it, this man's talk amounts to it's not convincing, it doesn't make sense. And so now the Buddha says, in the same way, you go on saying that splendor is the most perfect splendor, which is unsurpassed by any other splendor, but you don't show what that splendor is. Okay, so now I think Udayi is going to try to wiggle out of this embarrassing situation by giving an example, a concrete example. So he says, just as there would be a beautiful beryl gem, in Pali this is called valuvarya, or velurio, mani velurio, of the purest water, eight-faceted, well-cut, and is placed on a piece of red brocade, and it glows, radiates, and shines. Then he indicates what his real position is. He says, of such splendor, is the self, he uses the word atta, the self surviving unimpaired after death. Yeah, the Pali says, evang vano, so beautiful or of such splendor is the self, arogo. It means literally without illness, without disease, but the sense is that it continues indestructible after death. And so sort of the underlying position of Udayi, which he hadn't stated openly, is that there is such a thing as an inner self. Perhaps it corresponds to the Atman of some of the Upanishads. And this self is taken to be a reality which is splendid, beautiful, radiant, luminous. And with the death of the body, probably only of the enlightened person, the body falls away, but the self continues to exist in its own nature. And according to the commentary, the underlying position of Udayi is that the self becomes manifest or experienced in the third meditative absorption, which is called the third jhana. You know that there are four levels of meditative absorption, the four jhanas. And so according to Udayi's tradition, which would have been experienced by the early masters of that tradition, when one attains the third jhana, then one discovers the self, experiences the self. And probably it would be those who experience that third jhana that realize the self and thereby become immortal. When they achieve the third jhana, realize the self, then when they pass away, that splendid and radiant self continues forever, eternally after death. Okay, but now the Buddha is going to try to sort of upstage Udayi by using a counterexample. Here I'm in paragraph 12. He says, what do you think? Suppose we have this beautiful beryl gem placed on a piece of red brocade, and then we have a glowworm, or this is what we would call a firefly, in the thick darkness of the night. Of these two, which one gives off the splendor that's more excellent and sublime? And Udayi says, the glowworm in the dark night gives off more radiance than that beautiful beryl gem. Then the Buddha asks, which gives off more radiance, the firefly or an oil lamp? Udayi says, the oil lamp. Then it continues, how about the oil lamp and a bonfire? Which is more radiant? The bonfire. Okay, then the bonfire or the morning star towards dawn? It actually seems to me that the bonfire would give off more light than the morning star. But Udayi says the morning star towards dawn in a clear cloudless sky is more radiant. Okay, which is more radiant, the morning star or the full moon? The full moon. Which is more radiant, the full moon or the sun at noon on a clear cloudless day? Okay, the sun at midday is more radiant. Okay, so now the Buddha says, beyond this, I know of many gods who are even more radiant, more splendid than the sun and moon. Yet I do not say that there is no other splendor higher or more sublime than that splendor. But you say of that splendor, which is lower than the glowworms, that this is the perfect splendor, but still you haven't indicated what that splendor is. Okay, so this is, in a way, the Buddha is hitting rather hard on Udai. Doesn't it seem that way? And then Udai seems to feel the full brunt of the Buddha's argument. So he, in a way, he admits defeat. So he says, the Buddha, the Blessed One, has cut off the discussion. The Blessed One has cut off the discussion. So the Buddha says, why do you say that? Then Udai says, we say in our own tradition, we say, this is the perfect splendor, this is the perfect splendor. But when I'm pressed, questioned, and cross-questioned about our own teacher's doctrine, we are found to be empty, hollow, and mistaken. The Pali uses the word rita, which is like a cup that's empty, tucha, something which is hollow, without any substance to it. Aparadda means defeated or mistaken. Okay, but the Buddha doesn't want to allow Udai to feel defeated at this point. So he's trying to guide Udai step by step with instruction. So now he's going to direct Udai to an argument through a different line of questioning. So he asks Udai, is there an exclusively pleasant world? That is some realm of existence which is entirely, exclusively pleasant and happy. And then is there a practical path or way to realize an exclusively pleasant or happy world? Okay, then Udai says, it is taught in our own teacher's doctrine, there is an exclusively pleasant world, and there is a practical way to realize an exclusively pleasant world. And as we'll see, again, the Buddha, or maybe here for the first time, the Buddha is coming in, homing in on the third jhana, which seems to support the explanation given in the commentary about the position that underlies Udai's assertion, this is the supreme splendor. Because if you remember the formula for the jhanas, in the first jhana, we have thinking, what's called vitukka, mental application, and vichara, examination. Then we have rapture, or joy, and sukha, pleasure. In the second jhana, or to reach the second jhana, vitukka and vichara, mental application and mental examination fall away, and there's joy and pleasure. Then to go to the third jhana, the joy falls away, and there remains a state of very subtle, refined pleasure or happiness. And that state of the third jhana, if it's achieved and mastered, and one is able to retain it up to the time of death, then one will be reborn in the realm of existence that corresponds to the third jhana. And that realm of existence is called the realm of, maybe you translate it, refulgent glory. In Pali, it's the Subha-Kinha realm. So each jhana, when it's mastered, becomes the causal basis for achieving rebirth in a particular higher realm of existence. The first jhana is the entryway, or you could say the causal foundation for rebirth in the Brahma realm, the Brahma world. So the great Brahmas are those who have mastered the first jhana. Then those who master the second jhana take rebirth in what is called the Abhasara, which means the realm of streaming radiance. Abhasara. Streaming light, streaming glory. Then the third jhana is the passage, the entryway to Subhakina, the realm of refulgent glory, refulgent beauty. And that's supposed to be a realm of great bliss, very pure happiness, but it's a transient, impermanent realm. And the way to enter that realm, as I said, is through the third jhana. And according to the commentary, the early teachers of Udayi, like the teachers' teachers, we have grandfathers and great-grandfathers, so the grand teachers and great-grand teachers of Udayi were yogis who had mastered the third jhana. They were able to achieve it. They experienced this great inner radiance and beauty. They spoke about it. They taught it. They taught the path to achieve it. But as one generation followed another generation, probably they started to form texts and scriptures based on this experience. And then the later students just started to learn the sayings, the philosophy about this beautiful splendor. And they forgot the practice. They neglected the practice of the jhanas. They probably abandoned the practice of the deep meditation for the practice of asceticism. And so they lost the actual experience of the jhana. And so all by Udayi's time, the Buddha's time, all of those students in this lineage, all that they preserved was a saying, that is the supreme splendor, that is the supreme splendor. But the actual experience and the real practice leading to that experience had vanished. They had lost it. And so the Buddha asks Udayi, is there a practical way to realize this exclusively pleasant world? And Udayi says that it's taught in our own tradition. There is an exclusively pleasant world, and there is a way to realize an exclusively pleasant world. Then the Buddha asks, what is the way to realize that exclusively pleasant world? Then Udayi explains basically four of the five precepts. One abstains from killing living beings, one abstains from stealing, one abstains from sexual misconduct, one abstains from false speech, or else he undertakes and practices some kind of asceticism. So this seems to be all that remained of the practice within that tradition, observing precepts and undertaking austerities. In fact, I have to say sometimes at certain periods within the Buddhist tradition in some of the South Asian countries, even the tradition of meditation had been almost lost, except maybe a few monks living deep in the forests. And so many monks, all they would do is observe the precepts of the monastic code and then undertake not the extreme asceticism, but think that by maybe observing certain of the duttangas, the ascetic practices, that this is the way to achieve nibbana, But then eventually in the late 19th century, then there came a renewed interest in meditation, and then it started to spread through the 20th century till there came a kind of revival of the meditative traditions. Okay, so now the Buddha is going to use his style of dialectical argumentation. Paragraph 22, he says, "What do you think, Udayi? When one abandons the killing of living beings, does one then feel only pleasure or both pleasure and pain?" Then Udayi says, "On that occasion, one experiences both pleasure and pain." In fact, the Buddha, I see, this is an interesting point. The Buddha uses the text uses the expression tasmin samaye atta hoti sukha dukhi va. It really should be translated literally. Does the self then feel only pleasure or both pleasure and pain? Then the answer is both pleasure and pain. So he's referring to the self as the subject of experience. So you see, according to the teaching of that tradition, the self should be always blissful, always pleasant. But now he's saying that on that occasion, the self experiences both pleasure and pain. So it can't be exclusively blissful, exclusively pleasant. Similarly, when one takes what, when one steals, if one indulges in misconduct regarding sense pleasures, if one speaks falsely, if one abstains from stealing, abstains from sensual misconduct, abstains from false speech, on that occasion one experiences both pleasure and pain. Similarly, when one undertakes the ascetic practices, does oneself then feel only pleasure or both pleasure and pain? And Udayi says, on that occasion, one experiences both pleasure and pain. So then the Buddha says, can the realization of an exclusively pleasant world come about by following a path that involves a mixture of pleasure and pain? In other words, if the path, which is the cause, has both pleasure and pain, then it can't result in the fruit, which is a mixture of pleasure and pain. It can't result in a fruit which is exclusively pleasant and blissful. Okay, so now, paragraph 23, Udayi realizes again that he's been pushed into a corner. And so he says, the Buddha has cut off the discussion. The Buddha has cut off the discussion. Why do you say that? Then Udayi says, in our tradition, it's taught there is an exclusively pleasant world, and there is a practical path to realize that pleasant world. But when I'm questioned about this, my statements or my position turns out to be empty, hollow, and mistaken. And now Udayi, he's humbled, and so he asks the Buddha, how is it, Bhante, that there is an exclusively pleasant world, and how is there a practical way to realize an exclusively pleasant world? And then the Buddha says, there is an exclusively pleasant world, and there is a way to realize an exclusively pleasant world. Then the Buddha gives the case, paragraph 25. Somebody enters first jhana, second jhana, third jhana. So the third jhana, that is the practical way to realize an exclusively pleasant world. So the Buddha is talking about the path to realize an exclusively world. Then Udayi says, that is not the practical way to realize an exclusively pleasant world, but at that point, an exclusively pleasant world has already been realized. But the Buddha says, at that point, an exclusively pleasant world has not yet been realized, but that is only the practical way to realize an exclusively pleasant world. Okay, now when the Buddha says this, then Sakaludai's assembly starts making a loud noise, and they say, we are lost. In our own doctrine is lost. We're defeated. Our own doctrine is defeated. For we know of nothing higher than that. Because, actually, I have to say this isn't completely clear to me. Anybody have some idea about this? Maybe somebody understands us better than I do. Yeah, please.
I mean, it sounds like this, I guess, Jain philosophy is saying that the ultimate blissful world is arrived at the point of jhana, and the Buddha is saying that there's something, that that's not the ultimate, that there's something more.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think that's the point. But one thing I should say, this isn't the Jain position. Earlier, Udai referred to the Jains. It was the leader of the Jains who was making that assertion about being omniscient, all-knowing. But Udai himself is not a Jain. We don't know what school he belonged to. It seems to be some kind of maybe a Brahminic tradition. Maybe based on texts like the Upanishads. But it would make sense if the Udai and his followers had some knowledge, acquaintance, at least with the theory of the third jhana, even if they hadn't actually experienced it. And then when the Buddha says that is not the exclusively pleasant world, but that's only the way to realize an exclusively pleasant world, then it would seem that the Buddha has realized something called the exclusively pleasant world that goes beyond the third jhana. So now Udai asks the Buddha, at what point is an exclusively pleasant world realized? Okay, then the Buddha answers with the description of the way to enter the fourth jhana. So this seems to indicate what lies beyond the third jhana that Udai and his followers have not heard about, don't know about. So he says, with the abandoning of pleasure and pain, with the disappearance of joy and grief, the monk enters and dwells in the fourth jhana, which has neither pain nor pleasure, and has the purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. Okay, so now the monk achieves the fourth jhana, and the fourth jhana in the Buddha system is the basis for developing supernormal powers, including the power to go to other realms of existence and to meet the beings who live there. And so based on this achievement of the fourth jhana, this monk is able to visit that exclusively pleasant world. That would be the world, the Subhakina world, the world that's exclusively pleasant, and he's able to dwell together with the deities in that world, to talk with them, to have conversations with them. And it is, the Buddha says, that at this point that an exclusively pleasant world has been realized. I have to say this also, it's not so clear to me and not completely, not what I would expect. It would seem to me what would make better sense to speak about, to realize an exclusively pleasant world, some meditator enters and dwells in the third jhana, then with the breakup of the body after death, he is reborn in an exclusively pleasant world. In other words, in that realm of existence that's exclusively pleasant. That makes better sense than arising in that, just dwelling with those deities, talking with them, conversing with them. But anyway, this is what the text says. So. Okay, but now we come to the more interesting point. Udai now says, he says, surely it is for the sake of realizing that exclusively pleasant world that the monks lead the holy life under the Blessed One. So Udai now thinks that the monks are leading the spiritual life, I would say, to be reborn in that world which is described as exclusively pleasant. Or else maybe for developing that supernormal power of being able to visit that world. But the Buddha says that's not the reason why they live the holy life under me, but they're a state superior to this, and it is for this reason that the monks live this holy life under me. Then Udai asks, what are those superior states? And then the Buddha goes on with the gradual training, going, starting from the very beginning up to the overcoming of the five hindrances, entering the four jhanas, then based on the four jhanas, recollecting the past lives, arousing the divine eye, and then finally understanding the four noble truths and reaching the destruction of the defilements, the liberation of the mind. And so that takes us all the ways through paragraph 44. Okay, so then at the end, the Buddha says, these, Udai, are those higher and more sublime states for the sake of realizing which the monks lead the spiritual life under me. Okay, when the Buddha says this, then Sakaludai, he's delighted, and he expresses his appreciation. He says, it's magnificent, it's wonderful, how you have made the Dhamma so clear to me. Then he says, actually, now he's the leader of a group of followers, but he says, now I go for refuge to the Buddha, I go for refuge to the Dhamma, I go for refuge to the Sangha. So he's declaring himself a follower, a disciple of the Buddha, and then he asked the Buddha to become a monk under the Buddha. He says, I want to receive the going forth, that's the, to enter upon the monk's life under the Buddha. And I want to receive the full ordination, the full admission under the Buddha. And so now he's ready to give up his own position as the leader of a community and to really start from the beginning, becoming a novice monk under the Buddha, and then maybe getting the ordination, becoming just a pupil of the Buddha, giving up his all the prestige and honors and respect that he gets from all of his followers. But what happens? Then his own group of disciples start protesting. They say, don't lead the holy life under the ascetic Gotama. They say, you've been a teacher, you're a teacher. We're your pupils. Maybe they have a few dozen pupils. Could even be maybe 100 pupils. Even usually the texts speak about 500 pupils. So a whole group of pupils. And they're all protesting and saying, don't do it. Don't go back and become just like a pupil. It's like somebody who has a PhD, maybe PhD in electrical engineering. Then he thinks, why do I want to study electrical engineering? I want to study musical composition. I want to become a musical composer, but I've never studied music before. So I have to start taking my beginning piano lessons, doing the scales, give up my job. Maybe I'm an electrical engineer with a PhD, maybe a professor of electrical engineering in the university. And now I want to give all of that up and just start taking musical lessons, playing on the piano, twinkle, twinkle, little star, how I wonder where you are, like a diamond in the sky. How does it go? What's the next line? Up above the world so high, like a diamond in the sky. I think I sang that since I was 5 years old. Okay, so then to convince him, they use a simile. This would be just as if a water jug, which is a jug which is able to contain where you store water, maybe gallons and gallons of water, if it were to turn into a pitcher. But actually, I think my example is better. Just as if a professor of electrical engineering were to become a beginning student of the piano. So do not lead the holy life under the recluse, under the ascetic Gotama. Do not, after you're a teacher, don't become a pupil again. Now, in some suttas, it's in the Majjhima Nikaya, but I don't think we have the text here. I think it was 92, Sutta 92. Yeah, there's a Brahmin, this is page 761. There was a Brahmin by the name of Sela who had many students. And he approached the Buddha, had a conversation with him, and then Sela was convinced that the Buddha is the enlightened one. And so Sela decides, even though he's been a prominent teacher of 300 Brahmins, but he decides, you're the enlightened one. I take refuge in you. And I want to become your pupil, to become a monk under you. And so this is on the bottom of page 760. Sela addresses his own disciples. He says, oh, sirs, hear this, hear what he says. This is the man of vision, the physician, the mighty hero who roars like a lion. Who wouldn't believe him when he saw that he is the one, the incomparable one, who has crushed all of Mara's hordes of demons? He says, now I am going to go forth under him. Whoever of you wants to follow me, come along and join me. And who doesn't want to follow me, they can go their own way. But on the top of page 761, all of his disciples say, oh sir, if you approve of the Buddha's teaching, we too will go forth under him, this man of lofty wisdom. And then the Brahmin Sela and all of his assembly, they all receive ordination, they become monks under the Buddha, and then eventually they all become arahants. But in this case, it says that the Wanderer Sakaludai's assembly obstructed him from leading the holy life under the Blessed One. When they appealed to him, he realized he couldn't disappoint his followers by becoming a little novice pupil under the Buddha, and so he gave up his intention to become a disciple of the Buddha. And yet the Buddha gave two fairly long discourses to Udayi. Then the commentary gives some explanation of this. And again, what's said in the commentaries, don't always believe it 100%. Sometimes it could be, you know, just oral traditions that have been picked up by the commentary. But perhaps it's factual, we don't know. The commentary says that under the previous Buddha named Kassapa, Kassapa Buddha, the person who is now Sakaludai had been a Buddhist monk. And he had a friend who was also a Buddhist monk. And his friend wanted to disrobe and go back to the household life. And now properly, if one's monk friend wants to disrobe, one should try to persuade him to continue on as a monk, try to encourage him to remain a monk. But this monk, who was Udayi, was greedy to get the robe and bowl of that of his friend. And so when his friend said, I want to disrobe and become a householder, then Udayi said, yes, go ahead and disrobe. There's no harm in disrobing. You could lead a good life doing meritorious deeds as a householder. And so his friend disrobed, and Udayi got his, maybe it was a bowl, like one of these, a robe, like one of these nice, we all like the Burmese robes, which have this sort of reddish-brown color, strong material. So he got a robe like that, and maybe it was a bowl, like one of these Thai-style alms bowls that, if you see the bowl that I have, that's a Thai bowl. So he got a nice robe, nice bowl, and his friend disrobed. And so because he created unwholesome karma by not encouraging his friend to remain a monk, that became the obstructive karma that prevented him from continuing along this path to become a Buddhist monk under Buddha Gautama. But why did the Buddha spend all of his time conversing with him? Anybody know why? Yeah, good answer. Good answer. That's actually the correct answer. The Buddha foresaw that
he was on the right track.
Yeah, that the teachings that he would give him would become sort of seeds that would ripen in his going forth in a future life. And so the commentary explains that during the reign of King Asoka, maybe about 150 years after the time of the Buddha, this person who was Sakaludai now became a Buddhist monk by the name Asagutta. And during the reign of King Asoka, this monk Asagutta became an arahant who was distinguished for the power of his metta, his loving kindness. And so he radiated great loving kindness, and he attracted many pupils. And then King Asoka heard about his reputation and invited him three times to come to the palace to teach the Dhamma. But each time Asagutta would report back to King Asoka, I'm busy teaching the monks. If you want to see me, you come out to see me, but I can't go to the palace to see you. But I think it's said that King Asoka never went out to the forest to visit the monk Asagutta, and so he never got to meet him. Okay, any questions, comments? Please feel welcome to ask or speak. Yeah, please. To realize versus.
In this sutta, they speak about realizing a level of or jhana, and yet you've not yet entered beyond that. For instance, they would sort of it would become an entryway by way of.
Yeah.
I'd like
I'm still not quite sure that I understand. Maybe try to express that question again. One accomplished.
A subtle difference between realized and accomplishment. You can take somebody else's question while I look for it.
Okay. I mean, entering upon, no, that's, I mean, realizing.
How is it with page 658, paragraph 20, how is it Udayin, there is an exclusively pleasant world, is there a practical way to realize an exclusively pleasant world?
Yeah. Yeah.
Of realization versus accomplishing it.
Well, basically, it would be through the practical way that one would accomplish it. Now, the word that's translated to realize, the Pali literally means to witness, to testify to see for oneself. Yeah, exactly, yeah. Somebody else have some questions? Evan in the back?
When they were talking about abstaining from killing living beings and there being pleasure and pain in
them,
I get confused how there's pleasure and pain.
Yeah. Well, I guess the idea might be that somebody who is accustomed to killing living beings might find it painful to abstain from killing living beings, and yet they make the effort to abstain. And so by making that effort, on the one hand, it causes some pain, they experience some pain, and yet they have the pleasure maybe of a clean conscience, knowing that they're not killing living beings.
Yet,
maybe did you have some comment, Evan?
Yeah,
you put your.
I read that as making the more general point that even if you keep the precepts, you're still suffering.
Yeah, that's
not my precept, it's not liberation.
So even if you're observing the precepts, of course, that is the case, yeah, yeah.
That's what I understood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess that's the case too, yeah.
You could
Did Katrin, did you have some?
Benefit of in killing a being that you would be partaking of its flesh and getting and thereby getting pleasure?
No, I don't think that is intended here.
Okay.
First, because generally vegetarianism wasn't compulsory in many of the sects during the Buddha's time, including amongst the Buddhas themselves.
Oh, so perhaps the pleasure would be benefiting by the pleasure of killing a being and partaking of its flesh.
No, in my view, the pleasure would be the pleasure of having this clear conscience that one is not killing living beings.
Is it synonymous that the pleasure and pain is...
Actually, I think this is the sense... I think this is the sense, actually. Now I look at the Pali, it becomes clear. Yasmin samaye. Okay, on the occasion, at the time, when one has abandoned the killing of living beings and one has abstained from living beings, at that time is one experiencing exclusively pleasure? Is the self experiencing exclusively pleasure? Or is it both experiencing both pleasure and pain? Okay, now, it's not really related so much to the act of abstaining from killing living beings itself, but it's on that occasion, that is, at that time, one is not yet in a state which is exclusively pleasant. That state that's exclusively pleasant would be the third jhana. So one is still like going about one's day-to-day activities, ordinary activities, but one has taken the decision, I'm abstaining from killing living beings. But as one goes about one's ordinary day-to-day activities, sometimes there'll be pleasure, sometimes there'll be pain. So one is subject under ordinary, normal consciousness, mundane consciousness. One is subject constantly to the change of pleasure and pain. So it's only when one goes into the third jhana that one is experiencing a state which is exclusively pleasant. Yeah, yeah. Okay, any further questions? Okay, then I think we'll end for the day with the sharing of the merits. And we'll have the next class will be, we'll make it May 18th. That's a Tuesday. Anybody have a calendar? I'm pretty sure it's the 18th. Okay, 18th and 25th. Yeah. And the sutta will be, the next sutta will do... Maybe this might be a little interesting. It's not a very profound sutta, a little bit legendary in character, but just look at it, see what kind of lessons are being imparted. Sutta number 81, Gatikara the Potter. Then after that, we'll do 82, we did already. 83, maybe not that interesting. 84, arguments against the caste system, not so relevant to us. 85, maybe 86, the Angulimala Sutta will be interesting. Again, we're turning now from the realm of philosophy and deeper teachings, to call us stories, narratives. But they're always kind of some point being made, some kind of teaching being transmitted, even in these legends and narratives. Okay, so let us end with the sharing of the merits. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanang. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanang. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mang parang. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe devanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe satanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.